This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about immigration law. This is part two of our immigration law podcast, so please do listen to our part one. I am joined today by Barrister Alexander Swain from 10 King's Bench Walk Chambers in London. Having been awarded a Master's in International Human Rights, Alexander is highly experienced in immigration and asylum law, and he frequently advises and represents parties in the first-tier tribunal, upper tribunal, high court, and in the Court of Appeal. Alexander is also an associate lecturer of the Bar Professional Training Course at the University of the West of England. Thank you so much for joining me again, Alex.
Thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you back on our podcasts.
Thank you.
And so let's just tell our listeners very, very quickly what we discussed in part one. So anybody tuning into our part two, if they do want to listen into that conversation, then they know what to expect from that. So in part one, we discussed what is meant by immigration law. Does immigration law protect all passport holders if they're in the UK with an immigration problem? I have been living in the UK for over 5 years. Will I be able to apply for settlement in the UK? What is meant by Home Office fees? What is meant by the immigration health surcharge fee? And how has Brexit affected citizens from the European Union currently living in the UK? So that's what we had a nice chat about in part one. Let's come to part two. So, Alex, tell us, has the COVID crisis affected immigration law in the UK? I mean, COVID, I don't think, is going away in terms of the effects of it very soon. What do you think about that? What do you think the effects have possibly been on immigration law?
I mean, in terms of, you know, the law and procedure governing immigration in the United Kingdom, that has not been changed by COVID-19. There hasn't been a change, for example, to the immigration rules or to international or national law, which governs when a foreign national can come into the United Kingdom. That hasn't been changed because of the pandemic. There have been administrative consequences in terms of how immigration hearings before the first tier tribunal and the upper tribunal in England and Wales are dealt with, and the management of cases has changed, whereby judges will now look at the case for the foreign national who wants to either enter the UK or stay in the UK, and will look at the Home Office's position if they're saying no in advance of the hearing. The management of the cases before the tribunals is now what is called more front-loaded, where the judge will look at the case on the papers earlier and take a provisional view as to the merits of the case, invite further submissions, ideally on paper, from the parties to avoid the parties unnecessarily coming to court, and then following those further submissions, if there is still a substantial dispute as to whether the foreign national should be allowed to stay in the country or indeed enter the country, the judge will then consider how that hearing will be conducted, whether it can be conducted remotely via telephone or Skype or Microsoft
Teams.
And
that's another thing altogether, isn't it? We were just saying that before we pressed record, that actually on the 15th of March this year, I didn't even know what Zoom was. But
that's
now we're all doing business via Zoom. We're recording this podcast remotely via Zoom. And the courts have made huge adjustments. I mean, I'm not using Zoom, but they've all made huge adjustments to how they are hearing cases. And I think that in some cases, having remote hearings, and you're saying they're front loading the work that needs to be done to try and be, you know, sort of trim it down,
narrow the issues, they call it.
That actually, I think, could probably be more efficient.
I mean, there's certainly sense in the procedure that has been adopted. If despite the attempt to narrow the issues, there is still a dispute, then, as I say, the judge will consider how the final hearing will be conducted, if possible via remote means, but if not possible, by a face-to-face hearing. But obviously, with all the appropriate measures in place in terms of social distancing and so forth. But there has been, as I say, a shift, understandably, necessarily, in the case management of immigration cases, to see if whether or not an ultimate face-to-face hearing is
required. I mean, one of the things that I have been reading over the last few months is that obviously people that are actually here and waiting to extend their current visas or renew their current visas, that the Home Office has sent out newsletters that I've certainly seen as well, saying it's okay if you've overrun that time because of the fact that there's been lockdown, there's been shutdown, there's been social distancing measures in place. And I'm sure when things become more integrated, you know, there's going to be a backlog of work. So I know that that's happened as well. There's been a lot of understanding there by the Home Office, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, what I've seen specifically by way of a published announcement is the Home Office's considerations of applications from EU citizens who want to remain in the country post Brexit, and whether that is under the pre-settled status or the settled status, which we spoke about in part one. The Home Office have said we are still very much considering those applications, but there will be a delay in considering those cases because of COVID-19. They have noted, and inevitably there will be some delay in considering those applications from EU citizens.
Yes. So let's talk about human rights and asylum. What's the difference between a human rights claim and an asylum claim? Let's try and explain to our listeners what we mean by that.
Broadly speaking, a human rights claim, classically, in the UK, is when a foreign national wants to stay in the country, classically because of the ties they have developed while living here, whether that be by virtue of how long they've been here, but by virtue of family ties which they've developed during the course of their stay, whether that be with a partner or with a child. And because in that instance that their private and family life has developed to an extent, there is an argument that their human rights in terms of their family and private life should be protected. And that is a classic argument in terms of a human rights case. And you would be, in the first instance, looking at the Human Rights Convention 1950.
Just to say there, Alex, I guess what we're saying there is a part of that could be possibly that if you were to pick up your family and have to move and set up life in another country and leave the UK, the disruption potentially to family life and your life and your children's life will be such that it will be deemed to, you know, be a sort of a human rights issue.
Yeah. And the buzzword is the infringement on one's human rights proportionate.
I like that, the buzzword. I like that, Alex. We have to use that more often.
We use more buzzwords. And proportionate really means fair and reasonable.
Yes.
In the case of private and family life, that is protected by Article 8 of the European Convention. But it also the convention also protects certain other rights which come under the umbrella of human rights, such as more dramatically the right to life, the right not to be degraded, maltreated and tortured, and there are other rights such as the right to freedom of expression and the right to liberty and a right to a fair trial. So that comes under the umbrella really of a human rights claim.
Right.
An asylum claim is overlaps to a degree with a human rights claim, but is really far more specific in terms of a foreign national saying, I must be able to stay in the United Kingdom.
Because of danger of life, potentially.
Exactly.
And that's where the difference is, isn't it? Because you often get, like you say, that there is a clear overlap because your human rights are being infringed if you're fearing and you're scared and you're in danger. But that's really what we're saying, that asylum is related to if you're fearing for your life and if your life is in danger, whereas the human rights claim, as in its sort of purest sense, is more about if you have to disrupt your life to move.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. And an asylum claim will be on the basis that somebody fears going back home, and the buzzword for an asylum claim is persecution, that they will be persecuted because of something particular to them, something which is deemed a protected characteristic. And that may be race, nationality, sexuality, political opinion, gender. They will be harmed on account of their protected characteristic. That falls under an asylum claim. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think that's nice and clear. So one of the questions that we've been asked to discuss today is how do I change or vary my visa of leave or immigration status?
If the person in question is obviously in the United Kingdom with a visa. It is absolutely open to that person to apply to vary their visa, to
the
vary
type
the terms
of visa.
Which,
so, for example, from a student visa to a working visa may be a common sort of avenue, or from a working visa to a student visa, the other way around, perhaps.
Likewise, that can be done, and Section 3 of the Immigration Act 1971. Specifically provides for such a variation. It's important to apply to vary within the course of your existing leave, but that application can certainly be done. And if following the application to vary your leave, as you say, from being a student to maybe a worker, if the initial period of leave for working lapses, but you've made the application to vary within time of your initial leave, the application runs and you can still remain in the country while your application to vary is being considered.
That's an interesting point, because I have heard on more than one occasion that you've got to apply while you're still within your period of being allowed to stay during a valid visa.
That's important, yeah.
And then that sometimes can become tricky, I think, Alex, in my view, only because some applications say you can only apply a month before your actual visa is about to expire, and then a month might not be enough time to bring you into the bracket of still being within your visa.
Yeah, generally speaking... I mean, generally speaking, if, say, using the student example, and the student then wants to change the visa to a work visa, generally speaking, there isn't a specified time at which the application to vary can be made. That isn't in the rules.
That's probably more so for renewals then, I guess.
That comes more under the category of renewal. But if the student wants to vary to be a worker, that can absolutely be done. As I say, the important thing is to do it within the course of your current leave. But if the application to vary is still being considered by the Home Office, and the period of your initial leave has lapsed, you can still stay in the country while your application to vary is being considered.
Yeah, and I think that's a very key point, actually, because there are some misconceptions about that point alone.
Yeah.
So how does one check if their current immigration status is valid and compatible with the employment that they're in? What is there?
First of all, check your residence card. Your visa will actually, on the face of the card, set out any conditions that may apply.
For exclusions. Example,
yeah, exclusion, exactly. The main ones are, say, talking about students, a student will be able to work usually, but not full time. There'll be a maximum amount of hours a student can work.
And naturally, that's to prevent people from coming in on a student visa just for the purposes of working and no intention of studying.
You know, that's the main purpose of the visa is for study. But and another common condition is no recourse to public funds.
Let's explain that, Alex, because we've been asked on more than one occasion, what does that actually mean? So can we just give a little explanation about what that means?
Public funds is defined in the immigration rules under paragraph 6.
I love the way you know all the paragraphs and all the points. I mean, of course, you're a barrister, but I just love it. You just reel them off.
There we are. Yeah.
Brilliant. I love it because there's so
I'm
many immigration law. Yes, I'm sure you are. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
They really look at housing benefits, income support. Reliance on the NHS, interestingly, is not deemed reliance on public funds.
But that's interesting because that's probably the NHS is probably dealt in the health surcharge. So you pay surcharge, which means you pay, and we did discuss this in part one, you pay a small portion of money into the NHS fund so that you can get access to
it. You can then use it.
And
that's one of the reasons it's not actually included as a definition. It's more applications
benefits,
for
government
support, benefits, welfare support. That's deemed public funds. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Excellent. Okay. So we were talking about how to check if my current status is valid and compatible, and it's very simple. We're saying check your card.
Check your card. Check any letter from the Home Office when you were granted the visa, and if in any doubt,
I was just going to say,
read or contact the Home Office, write to them, or email,
give them a call, or something like that. Absolutely. Yeah,
conditions are quite usual for residents in the United States.
Yes, yes. No, I have to say, you know, people sometimes are afraid of contacting the Home Office.
And
I agree. Don't be, because actually they're there to assist. And what some people do is say, "Oh, I'll go and try and get some legal help to ask some simple questions," or you know, go to these visa companies that deal with visas specifically. And yes, of course, if something is quite complicated, by all means, do. But most of the time, if as you said, an email is a very efficient way of dealing with the Home Office. They're very helpful and they do give you, you know, key guidance and support. That's what they want to do because they don't want you to be in breach of the rules as much as you don't want to be in breach of the rules.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got time to discuss one last question and it's quite a biggie probably, but let's see if we can use a few buzzwords and answer this one in a nice way. So how does one bring a spouse, partner, child or a dependent in the UK if they're already in the UK with a valid visa to work, or maybe a student's visa?
That is quite a broad question, but the immigration rules certainly provide, if somebody is in a foreign national, is in the United Kingdom working with a visa, that they can bring in some family members. I say that with some caution, but if somebody is working as a what's called a general migrant under Tier 2 of the immigration rules, that does allow them to bring in their spouse or civil partner or children.
Now that's interesting when we say civil partner, because if you're not married and you claim that somebody is your partner, are we talking that they must have had some sort of civil partnership in place potentially like we've now got in the UK since sort of December 2019? Yeah. Are we talking about that? Or is it enough for someone to say, that's my fiance, they're my partner, or that's my girlfriend or my boyfriend, that's my partner? Is there a specific answer to that?
Well, yeah, it depends on the nature of the applicant. If the applicant is just working in the United Kingdom, the rules actually specify that it is spouse and civil partner or children. Other parts of immigration law, for example, the law currently governing EU nationals, it is slightly wider. And if there is an EU national in the United Kingdom, then it is possible for that person's family, including spouse, civil partner, but also a partner in the sense of long-term relationship. If you are looking at a case which is being governed by European law, EU law, then a partner can be allowed to join under the European Union provisions.
At the moment,
pre-Brexit.
Yes.
If looking at the example here, it appears somebody is here with a valid visa to work and is a non-European national, and that is governed by a different set of rules, which is called the points-based scheme, governing non-European nationals. And actually, in that category, the scope to bring in your family is slightly narrower, and that is when you are actually dealing with children, spouses, or civil partners.
I have to say, I mean, I was aware of a case a few years ago now where a non-EU migrant based here was not allowed to bring in their child. They were in their teens, but I think when the child came in originally, the child was 14. And by the time they got to do the application to keep the child here, and I think the firm that they were using, which was some sort of immigration firm, just dragged their heels, the child turned 16.
I see, yep.
And obviously there was very specific conditions that, you know, specific to their case, but they were not allowed to keep their child here at 16 because they were no longer a dependent, is what their argument was from the Home Office. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of things surrounding, because why would it take you 2 years to make the application to start or get to that point?
I mean, for non-EU cases, if you are a British citizen in the UK, settled, or you have humanitarian protection, like refugee protection, with those circumstances, you can bring in your children if you satisfy the rules for entry clearance.
And obviously, every case is different, and every case is independently reviewed by the Home Office.
Yeah,
because circumstances that, you know, may be specific to you that aren't specific to others, and the Home Office does take a case
to a degree. To a degree, I mean, the rules remain the same. The facts change, but the rules remain the same. But for a child to enter the United Kingdom, if the parent is British or in the UK with settled status or here with refugee protection, then the child can enter if certain requirements such as good character, ability to speak English, and also suitable accommodation and financial
can be provided,
is provided. So the rules really are fixed, but they do certainly accommodate for children to join people in this country if they are here under British citizenship, settled status, or refugee status.
Yes. Brilliant. Okay, Alex, another great podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed that. And I know we've got a list of another 7 or 6 questions that we haven't even touched upon. So our next part 3.
Well, there we are.
will probably be when we're out of Brexit. Yes. So that will make an interesting one as well.
That's for part three.
Absolutely. So thank you ever so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And what I will say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening. Empower yourself today with legal knowledge and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook to get access to jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient, and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Our episodes are free to access. However, if you feel that you would like to support the children's charity that we are raising money for, then head over to our Just Giving page at justgiving.com and search for Hattie Savari, where we are raising money for orphaned children at SOS Children's Villages, one of the worthiest children's charities. Donate as little as £1 for a great cause. Thank you.